Welcome back to Minds Matter, a podcast sponsored by the Monash Centre for Consciousness and Contemplative Studies. I'm Beth.
And I'm Ava. And on Minds Matter, we explore research from neuroscience to psychology while occasionally talking through our own personal experiences.
This week on the podcast, I spoke to Dr. Clara Callahan, who is a research fellow at the University of Sydney. And we kind of did a general episode on neurobiology and spoke about different neurotransmitters and neuromodulators. So we focus on serotonin and noradrenaline and how these act on the brain and the systems they're a part of. And we also spoke about her research on hallucinations and how neuromodulators relate to hallucinations, which was super interesting. We actually also speak a bit about my research. So you can hear scientists in the wild, how they start talking about ideas. So I hope you guys enjoy.
My name is Clara Callahan and I'm a research fellow at the University of Sydney, where I run my own modest little group there. And the background to me is that I first came into the area of research in neuroscience and such via training as a clinical neuropsychologist. So when I started my PhD, I actually had a clinical job where I was at part-time, and that was focused on dementia diagnosis and cognitive disorders and that sort of thing. So my PhD was actually much more of a clinical neuroscience focus, working in diseases like Parkinson's and different types of dementia and trying to understand cognitive and psychiatric symptoms in those disorders using funky behavioral tests and neuroimaging and that sort of thing. Then into my postdoc, I was really lucky to work in a more of a translational neuroscience lab over in Cambridge with Trevor Robbins, where they do rodent and monkey and human research. So I broadened my interests and expertise. And these days, I still have an arm of work that we do where we try to tackle some clinical problems. So working in Parkinson's disease and trying to understand some of the psychiatric and cognitive problems. And then the other arm of what I get to do is just picking different interesting problems about the brain and trying to understand them. And I suppose the types of tools that we use, neuroimaging and cognitive testing, and more recently, trying to build in single-dose drug studies, so where we do pharmacological manipulations to try and perturb these neuromodulatory systems to find out more about them.
So your work looks at neurobiology. Can you explain what that field is and why it's important for understanding behavior?
It's a very good question, and I don't know what the textbooks would say that the definition of neurobiology is, but the way I think about it is that it permits us to study behavior and psychological constructs and sensation and perception, all these sort of outward actions and behaviors that we think about it. But it permits us to study those within the framework of the actual sort of meat of what's going on in the brain, what's happening at the level of the brain in terms of neurons and networks and connections and things like that. The point of it is it's sort of not studying either of them in isolation. It's sort of trying to understand how these neurobiological processes, how the brain works, how it communicates with itself and the environment, and how then that ultimately leads to how our behaviors and actions unfold. I see its importance in giving us a wider umbrella to study the relationship between behavior and brain. And it behooves us in a way to constrain our ideas about behavior and action and perception, to constrain them within a biological framework. So that's how I see them complementing each other to solve the same problem of how does this mess of neurons in our head then generate this mess of behavior that we see out in the world.
So could you explain what the relationship is between a neuron and a neurotransmitter?
So there's so many ways to come at that question, but I suppose I'll explain it in a way so I can drive the conversation a little bit more towards some of the systems that I'm quite interested in and that me and my collaborators study. And these are the neuromodulatory systems of the brain. Really broadly speaking, if we imagine neurons and them being the substrate of the brain that passes information between each other, and then we have these chemical systems that facilitate that passing of information. And broadly, they're considered neurotransmitters. But we can make the distinction between neurotransmitters and neuromodulators. So neurotransmitters, if we imagine two neurons and how they might talk to each other between a presynaptic neuron and a postsynaptic neuron, we have this cascade of chemical events where neurotransmitters will make their way across the synaptic cleft to encourage an action potential in the next neuron. And the way we can think about neurotransmitters is these are classic ones that we think of in the brain that help this fast transmission of information. These are usually GABA and glutamate. And they tend to work at the level of one synapse or one neuron talking to one another at a synapse, right? So it's this like fast chemical signaling that underpins what our brain is doing. And then if we think of neuromodulators, they're also a class of chemical signals in the brain. The way we think of them is that they, in general, act in a bit of a slower way that modulates the fast signaling that happens at the level of neurotransmitters. So if you imagine your brain, diagram of your brain all wired up and connected, and then within that we've got fast acting neurotransmitters that sort of permit information to pass across those connections. Neuromodulators sit on top of that, helping modulate the speed and the type of transmission that is occurring at the level of neurotransmitters. So that's probably the clearest distinction between neurotransmitters and neuromodulators. You can think of the neurotransmitters as being much more faster acting and the neuromodulators having a sort of broader, diffuse mode of acting. But I suppose, taking an even further step back, the way we can think about these chemical signaling systems in the brain is the main thing that they tell us is that just knowing the connections and how neurons in the brain are wired up, that's just not enough, right? Because we know how everything is connected. But actually, on top of that, we've got these systems that can modulate the sort of strength of those connections or how likely they are to be interacting with each other versus interacting with another population over there. So these neurotransmitters, in particular the neuromodulators, they provide this extra overlay of flexibility to this wiring diagram made up of neurons and axons.
Great. Now we're going to speak about some individual neurotransmitters or neuromodulators. So to start off, could you please explain the role of noradrenaline?
So coming back to what we were talking about before, the idea of these sort of neuromodulators that help modulate the activity of this fast transmission that occurs between neurons and neurotransmitters. There's a number of these in the brain, but some of the most well-studied ones tend to be these sort of monoaminergic ones and cholinergic ones. So things like dopamine, serotonin, noradrenaline, and acetylcholine. And dopamine is far too famous. Everybody cares about it. So I don't want to talk about dopamine. But so noradrenaline is a very fascinating example of one of these neuromodulators. Before talking, I guess, more specifically about noradrenaline, two things to say is that, first of all, across these different neuromodulators, even though they have their own unique properties, there's a few sort of general things that they do share in terms that I've already mentioned, the way that they act as modulators in the brain rather than sort of facilitating synaptic transmission. And they tend to all come from relatively small populations of neurons that are often in the midbrain or the brainstem and then project diffusely throughout the brain. And they also tend to have these properties we describe as an inverted U curve, where there tends to be a sweet spot of optimal levels of these modulators that facilitate a particular behavior. And if you have too little or too much, that can sort of push behavior outside of optimal bounds sometimes, or it can help change the behavior. So that's a way to think about these neuromodulators as a sort of sharing certain traits. The other, I think, important general rule is that we often try to ascribe these one-to-one mappings between, dopamine does this, dopamine does reward, acetylcholine does attention, these sort of things. It's important not to get too wrapped up into these one-to-one mappings because these systems are involved in so many different things. And while it does help to come up with overarching system theories that help characterize what each one does, it's important to remember that they're involved in so many aspects of cognition and behavior, and it's a little bit of a misrepresentation to just ascribe them to one thing. But coming back to noradrenaline, if we try to give it an overarching sort of theory of what it does, it's particularly important for helping us engage and disengage with our environment. So that's often called the exploring versus exploiting. So whether we keep focused on a particular thing versus disengaging from that and going off to do other things. And a cool way to think about noradrenaline in relation to that is that we can see that idea at several different levels. So we can see it at the cellular level, where patterns of firing in the locus coeruleus, which is the brain's main source of noradrenaline, that tends to determine whether an animal or a human is actively engaged versus exploring their environment. At a second level, like a broader brain level, we know that different levels of noradrenaline permit networks to reconfigure. So that your brain is in and you're doing a particular task, a surge of noradrenaline can disengage that pattern so you can calibrate and do a new task. And then at the environmental level, we can think about what noradrenaline cares about. It's sort of that system is quite responsive to novelty or surprise in your environment. It gets it on board and sort of thinks, oh, do I need to check that out and do something different? Across those three levels, we have quite a bit of evidence to think about noradrenaline in this way that it helps permit engagement and disengagement with our environments.
That's super interesting. And before we go on to serotonin, which is, I think, is another of everyone's favorites, but what's the level of control we would have over how much noradrenaline? Is it something that's just like, it's just the brain's doing its thing, there's nothing we can do to maintain a certain level of that? Or is there some things that we can do to intervene with how much noradrenaline we're getting?
Well, if you believe pseudoscientific influencers on Twitter and stuff who are biohacking their dopamine and things like that,
right?
Then, you know, there's loads of things you can do to control those, right? But no, that's a silly answer to it. Is actually a very good question. And it brings me to, I guess, talk in a little bit more detail about how this system works. So the beauty of these neuromodulators is that they exert their influence on the brain in a way that reflects the immediate and even long-term needs of an organism. So based on what's going on in your environment or what your internal needs are, those internal and external demands are going to help shape levels of noradrenaline in your body or in your brain. So if you're just trundling along the street and minding your own business and maybe just sort of mind wandering away, perhaps noradrenaline levels aren't going to be that high. You're sort of just doing something automatic and there's nothing new going on. But if a tiger was to jump out of the bushes next to you and be chasing at you and causing all this havoc, you'd get this immediate surge of noradrenaline to signal that you're in this massively stressful situation. You need to completely recalibrate from what you're doing, change your behavior and get out of there. So the idea being that the baseline levels of where these neuromodulators are at is going to be sort of commensurate with your internal and external needs at that moment. And to what extent that then we can control them is the extent to which we can control our external and internal environment. If I'm sitting at home and just bored and doing nothing, I can take myself into a more stimulating situation, and that's going to have a big change on the baseline levels of these systems. Likewise, if you're just sitting and letting your mind wander, if you're just relaxing and just letting thoughts come to you, versus sitting there and actually thinking, okay, I'm going to think through a really complex scientific problem that I've been really trying to nut out and I'm trying to get this code right and trying to work it out. Even shifting your mental state in that way is going to cause a recalibration of where these levels are at.
This is super interesting. So now if you could explain a bit about serotonin, which I feel like it's got a lot of hype with the biohackers as well.
Biohackers, they're not into noradrenaline yet. But mine,
they're really not.
I know. I mean, once they get onto it, they'll realize just what it is for sort of, you know, creative thought and focus and that sort of thing. So yeah, just wait. Serotonin, again, it's like noradrenaline. I mentioned that the locus coeruleus is tiny nucleus in the brainstem. That's the brain's main source of noradrenaline. So it projects really diffusely to pretty much all areas of the brain. And serotonin shares a similar structure in that there's a few sort of serotonergic neurons in the brainstem that project really widely throughout the brain. So serotonin and noradrenaline are quite similar in that way. One way that they really do differ in terms of kind of complexity of these systems, so noradrenaline, I haven't mentioned yet the idea of different types of receptors for these neuromodulators. The idea being that these nuclei in your brain will produce these neuromodulators that then target a lot of different regions across your brain. But the effect that they are going to have in those target regions will often be determined by the receptors that are sitting there, right? So to go back to noradrenaline, because it's a more simple example, noradrenaline has sort of three classes of receptors that it acts upon. This is alpha 1, alpha 2, and a beta adrenergic receptor. So parts of the brain will have different distributions of these receptors. And also these receptors have different affinities for noradrenaline. And the way of thinking about that is that, for example, alpha 2, if it has a low affinity for noradrenaline in the prefrontal cortex, it just needs like a little bit of noradrenaline and it's waking up and doing its thing, right? So if an alpha 2 receptor is sitting on a neuron, you get like a little bit of noradrenaline, it's ready to go. Whereas, say, the alpha 1 and beta receptors in those same areas, they need a higher amount of noradrenaline to get going. So that's just to give a little intuition about the idea of these systems that project in a lot of different places that can broadcast a very global signal. They actually have a lot of specificity for several reasons, but a big one of them being the different distributions of receptors and the different sensitivity of the receptors to levels of noradrenaline. And to contrast with serotonin, it is way more complex in terms of its receptors because it's got about like 14 of them or something, or at least 14. So the effects of how it goes around the brain are a lot harder to pin down or easily encapsulate compared to the noradrenergic ones. Serotonin, it's got way more receptors, so it can have these quite complex effects throughout the brain. And again, like I was trying to do with noradrenaline, if we try to think of an overarching explanation of what serotonin does or how it modulates behavior and cognition, there's been a lot of work that links serotonin to quite specific things. So, for example, to aversive processing, to perseverative behavior, so whether you're being a bit flexible versus just doing the same thing over and over, and also to the idea of being able to wait and be patient. One recent overarching theory of serotonin actually links it really strongly to this idea of time, that serotonin is helping signal available time that an organism needs to make its decisions or achieve its goals. One way, in a paper from a couple of years back with some colleagues here and around the world, we had a crack at our own overarching explanation of serotonin. And just to say that it wasn't doing anything completely new that other people haven't done, we were sort of leaning on a lot of the ideas. But we framed it in terms of serotonin helping negotiate this balance between more sort of automatic forms of behavior. So doing something that you're used to in a way that you don't really have to think and you go into sort of autopilot mode versus more flexible and novel means of behavior. So just to break that down a little bit more and link it to the neurobiology a little bit more. So when we have low to intermediate levels of serotonin, the particular receptors, say in the frontal cortex, aren't as activated. So they're not as involved in whatever you're doing. Whereas receptors in the cerebellum at these low and intermediate levels come on board at these levels. So the idea being that perhaps at this sort of low intermediate levels of serotonin, you can shift into a bit more automatic, autopilot type behaviors. However, when you encounter a novel situation or you've got a new problem to solve, we imagine that these higher levels of serotonin in those situations, they're then able to activate these quite famous serotonin receptors, which are the 5-HT2A receptors that get a lot of attention now because of their role in psychedelics. But there's these 5-HT2A receptors in the prefrontal cortex that can be activated at higher levels of serotonin. And the consequences of them being more active is that the top-down input from these frontal areas of your brain becomes then more active. Those areas of the brain can then all of a sudden can shift into different configurations and different sort of neural ensembles that will permit novel or creative solutions to a problem. So the idea being that serotonin might help mediate this sort of access between whether you're in a little bit more automatic mode of behavior because perhaps you're in a familiar environment, so you don't need to think too much about what you're doing, versus these mode of behavior where, oh, you've got a novel problem to solve or you've encountered something new and I need to come up with a bit more of a flexible strategy. So that's something that we've been thinking a bit about in terms of serotonin and probably does relate a bit to some of the ideas in psychedelics and that sort of thing.
Yeah, now this is just a personal question, but I was just thinking about my rats. So I actually met Claire a few weeks ago where I went and presented some work with her group and another group in Sydney. And this is work that I'm doing in my PhD where we give rats psilocybin. So that's the psychedelic that you guys might know as magic mushrooms. And then we measure their behavior for 14 days after they're given the dose. And we do this computational modeling methods and look at their information processing and the behavior of the rats. And what we find is that the psilocybin-treated rats engage more in their environment. And so they get more rewards from the tasks that they're doing. And when we look at the computational model parameters, which is how the rat's making the decision, we find that we have changes in parameters that are related to optimism. So we see that the rats become more engaged in their environment, and that could be due to a more optimistic outlook. So when just listening to Claire then, I was thinking, oh, how could this framework and understanding serotonin relate to what we found in the rats?
Yeah, I can see it fitting on this axis of more flexible exploratory behavior versus more habitual automatic type behavior. Yep. So one of the pieces of evidence that fits into that framework is that there's lots of studies in monkey and rodent models where lower levels of serotonin are associated with more perseverative responding. So that's the idea that you're just doing the same thing regardless of whether your environment has changed or whether it makes sense or not. So you can imagine that being a behavioral mode where you're sort of, I don't know, stuck in a rut. You're just doing the same thing regardless of whether your environment is novel or not and that you should be doing something different. Whereas higher levels of serotonin might permit this state that can pull you out of that type of behavior because you've got this sudden sort of increased flexibility in your brain state that can explore novel neural ensembles and things like that to come up with different or creative solutions to change the setting that you're in. I can see that linking with the optimism ideas, because I suppose the opposite of optimism is perhaps this pessimistic state where you think, oh, nothing's going to change and I'll just keep doing the same thing and I don't get any difference from it. Whereas sort of something about optimism and increased engagement with your environment, which I think is the measure that you were talking about that underpins this optimism parameter, I do think that requires this more flexible exploratory mode of behavior that would fit, I think, with this more augmented 5-HT2A serotonin signaling.
Because I was thinking, so if you get the influx of serotonin and you have the novel perspective and everything, and then you go out and engage in the environment and you do learn that there's a reward there, then long term that can shift the behavior. Like that could be the mechanism of how that changes it after a long time after the dose. It's this, oh, then I have learned that there's this shift in like getting me out of the rut has learned that there are good things out in the world. So now I'll keep doing it.
Yeah, I think that you've put it really beautifully. And I think that actually gets to one of the sort of incredible mysteries when, you know, we think about these neuromodulatory systems, because they sort of give us both flexibility and stability, which is a strange thing to think about because they're almost opposite. But you need the different configurations of these neuromodulators can sort of increase your degrees of freedom. It can open you up to possibilities in the environment. It sort of shifts you away from what you're doing and in a way expands your scope of attention, right? To look for other options and see what's out there. But at the same time, just be permanently in that state, you need to sort of then expand and then you need to then narrow your focus and to try to then exploit a behavior. So they give us this flexibility to initiate new behaviors and explore the world, which sets the stage for new learning, right? Because you're not going to learn anything new unless you're out there looking around being exposed to things. But then the different engagement of neuromodulators permits stability to persist at learning and execute the thing that you're then trying to do.
This is awesome. This makes me so excited because another thing when we're talking to a lot of the clinicians and thinking about psychedelics for therapy, there's always this big discussion on how important it is that their environment is a good one. So someone might be struggling with mental health because their environment it actually isn't beneficial for them to go out and explore because they're in an unsafe environment. Yeah. And that just goes back to if we're doing these interventions, we really need to make sure that when that person goes out to explore, there is a reward there for them.
That's a fantastic point. And I think it probably touches back onto some of the older literature in serotonin is around learned helplessness and anxiety, right? So again, you're getting at a really important point that it's not just sort of the levels of these neuromodulators within our brain and within our body. It's whether they're kind of relating in that adaptive way to our environment, right? So like the example that I gave before, if you've got the tiger jumping out at you and you get this surge of noradrenaline, surge of serotonin, that sort of sets you up to do all these novel things, run away and that sort of thing. But if you're in an environment where you can express those exploratory strategies or those new strategies, then that's going to be completely adaptive behavior, right? However, if you're getting these high levels of noradrenaline or serotonin and you're not in an environment where you are able to explore new affordances, or if it's not safe to explore new affordances, that's just going to contribute to sort of high levels of stress because everything inside of you is saying, go out and try and have a look, but then you can't. And some of the animal work shows that when animals are in that situation, they develop this learned helplessness because they've got high levels of stress and anxiety that they can't do anything about.
We obviously spoke about noradrenaline and Claire gave a really good explanation of some of the roles of noradrenaline. And I thought I would share with you my own personal noradrenaline experience. So I just want to preface this with everyone is fine and okay, but I was in a bus crash a few weeks ago And this was the first kind of accident like this I've been in, and it was pretty hectic. We were like ended up off the road and a truck was kind of stuck to us. And it was really, I mean, it was awful, but it's really interesting the experiences I had in the moment and afterwards. I reckon after a week after, because of the surge in all these different neuromodulators trying to get me to make sure I was okay. And it was funny talking to Claire after this had happened, because during that experience, I was like, oh, wow, this is crazy that the brain can do something and completely change the way you're perceiving the world, reacting, and not in a little sense, like in a really, really profound sense. So when the accident happened, I was sitting on the bus, and you just sit on the bus and you just assume you're going to be fine. So you're like listening to your music on the way to uni, a bit asleep. And then all of a sudden we started going off the road, and everyone started screaming and they all fell over. And then the truck started crushing in on us, and like the window was at all smashed. And at that moment, it was like time was really, really slow. My brain was like, went from, okay, everything's fine. I was listening to the new, it's been 20 years since the Modest Mouse album, Good News for People Who Like Bad News. So I was listening to like their 20-year special album thing. And I was like, oh my God, I used to love this album, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden it's like my attention completely changed and time went so slow. And I can remember like every little moment so vividly.
Wait, so people fell over in the bus? Like it was like, yeah, it fully...
because we people stand up because not everyone can sit down. Mm-hmm. And because we stopped so quickly, because we crashed into a pole, everyone who wasn't sitting down went flying.
That's crazy.
And then where I was sitting, I jumped out of my seat, landed on my feet, which is crazy because my window was all... All that hot Pilates.
Yeah.
Because my window was like all like cracking into a million pieces. It didn't fall in because I have this protective layer. But then after, so everyone's screaming, everyone like yells out, is everyone okay? Everyone is okay. Then everyone was in complete shock and no one did anything. I guess because there was no immediate injury or something, but it felt like we were waiting for that to happen. Then everyone just stood completely still and no one did anything, but we couldn't, but the truck was stuck on us and it starts like pulling it off, but we're all on the bus and then we couldn't open the doors because they'd all stopped working.
Oh
no, it was
so
like,
were you on the side of, like, were you knocked over?
No, we were still standing up straight.
Okay.
So the truck was just like on the side of us.
What happened? Like, well, did the truck hit you and then you rammed into a pole?
Yeah, merged onto us, I guess. And then the bus driver was like, oh, I got it. And then was like, got to go off the roads. And then we went into a pole.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And then, so then everyone's just standing there. And then one girl, who I think is like really smart, started screaming, we've got to get off the bus. We've got to get off the bus. And then someone pulled the emergency exit so we could get off. But then the people at the front didn't leave. It was like no one then knew what to do.
Mm.
And it felt like, looking back in that situation, if I was not in my noradrenaline state of mind, I would have done something. But I was just also in shock, like, oh, what's going on?
How long do you feel like the actual crash lasted, even though it felt like it was really long?
Probably like 2 seconds. But it's kind of crazy how we're so able when something like that happens. You can have this surge of these neuromodulators and it changes all the message passing and you can completely be like, all right, this is what I need to do now because we're in a really dangerous situation. But it's so quick the way we can change that, you know, and from this completely restful singing along to Modest Mouse state to to like just totally, you know, scariest state you can imagine.
Yeah, that's so scary. When you texted, you were like, I've just been in a bus crash. I was like, what?
And then afterwards, my whole week was weird because of this. Mm. And it was good because I come to the lab and I've got all these people here. So I've got Kevin and doctors and things who actually know what to do in these situations. So I came here and they were like, this is how you're going to feel for the rest of the day and the week because you've had all of this happen. And so that was helpful to know that. But yeah, then you're really tired. And then I just slept so much for the whole week.
So, okay, one of the things that I found super interesting about this episode was I feel like for me, when I think about these neurotransmitters, first of all, I'm not going to lie, I had to Google noradrenaline because I was like, noradrenaline, adrenaline, epinephrine, and like their function. And then as you talked about, we don't talk as much about noradrenaline, but I feel like what you're describing is what I would have described as a non-expert in these neuromodulators. Which are they also hormones? I have so many questions. But these neuromodulators, I would be like, that's adrenaline. Like, I feel like that was an adrenaline response. Although maybe the adrenaline, I would have expected people to start doing a bunch of stuff instead of being in a stupor. So I don't know, like, how much do we really know about these systems, I guess?
One thing I will say, and I think it's really important, and Claire did say this, is it's not a one-to-one mapping. And I feel like that's such a big message in our podcast. Nothing's a one-to-one mapping. And it's not with these neuromodulators either. So it's not like one thing does one thing. It's a whole like cascade of systems, which I guess makes sense because we don't live in a one-to-one mapping world. So I guess I'm using the bus crash as a way to describe, but it wasn't like there was just a surge of one thing and then I did this one thing. It was a lot of things going on. But it was interesting the way my brain and behavior and everything changed so quickly, and the mechanisms that are in place to allow me to do that are from these neuromodulators. And I think that's so interesting that we can have those messages pass so quickly and it can just have a whole change over everything. I think that's pretty cool. The example of the bus crash is exactly what Claire was saying this role of noradrenaline is, because I have this thing and it's telling me, okay, my environment's changed. Do I need to do something different? Like, I need to switch up what I'm already doing. So it's this, yeah, I guess this ability to be like, all right, we've got to, the actions that we're doing at the moment and not, we've got to do something different and we've got to do it quickly. And I guess any of you who have been in a situation like that have experienced it.
What I found really interesting about it was most of the neuro that I'm exposed to is very much at the systems level or the brain region level, where it's more like activity in general of the brain, which I feel like I'm biased to think about it more as the electrical activity that's happening in the brain, which is obviously related to this. But in the way that I'm usually thinking about these kinds of processes, to me, I'd be like, oh, what would happen in that situation if you're in the bus crash? I'd be like, amygdala, which is like the place in the brain, which is about salience and threat, but specifically salience, but threat is usually pretty salient. But it was just interesting to me because I was like, gosh, these things definitely are interacting and there must be a good amount of work connecting these different levels of analyses. But even as someone who does some neuro work, I was like, wow, I don't know what's going on with these neuromodulators really at all. And it's not something that if you were to read a paper about threat that's just in the context of the brain regions and the functional connectivity between these regions, maybe there would be like some notes about some of the neuromodulators, but you wouldn't have something just describing how that neuromodulator influences the relationships between those different regions of the brain, for instance. And I guess from Claire's description, that is what's happening, right? That these neuromodulators come on and they influence how fast these messages are able to pass between different regions. But it was just really interesting to like think about it that way because I just realized how much I hadn't been thinking about it that way. And also how complicated these things are, because I think definitely I would have said, oh, it's adrenaline. And if someone asked me what noradrenaline was, I would have said, I have no idea. The thing that comes before, after, not sure.
No, I 100% agree with you, because it's so interesting thinking about the different levels. And I think whatever level of research we're doing is important, but then to think about, okay, well, ideally, how could we connect all those levels together? So I look at computational models, which have some theories about how these neuromodulators link to these, but that's not what I look at in my work. But then I was thinking exactly the same thing as you, Ava. All these levels talking to each other. Because at one stage I was like, wait, do these other levels exist or is it just only neuromodulation? I don't know. It just ends up because you – do you know what I'm saying?
No, I feel exactly what you're saying. Listening to this episode and also listening to the bus story, if it's framed in that way and if you're thinking of it in that way, it's so apparent why people get tunnel vision, because it's like, oh, this is so important. And also it feels like there are mechanisms that make sense on all of these levels. So you can say, oh, it's maybe hormone neuromodulator that is coming online and that's influencing everything else. That's kind of the base of where this reaction comes from. Whereas someone who's working on amygdala response would be like, oh, it's the amygdala talking to this prefrontal cortex region. So I understand why people zoom in so much into something and then have a hard time listening to other scientists saying that maybe that's not the most important thing.
Or if you're a computational modeler, you'll be like, oh, your precision for this policy, you know, it would be a totally other way of looking at that experience. And then if you're a physicist, you're just like, well, what's their whole thing? Like, we don't exist, or I don't know.
What is it that sociologists are just psychologists and psychologists are just neuroscientists and neuroscientists are just biologists and biologists are just chemists and chemists are just physicists?
And then what are the physicists?
Philosophers.
Related to what we've been talking about in terms of the psychedelics is that you research hallucinations as a symptom in different disorders. Can you explain what a hallucination is and how hallucinations are related to neurotransmitters or neuromodulators?
So I always feel a bit embarrassed to get asked about hallucinations because it's always been kind of side interest that I've worked in. I think because it's such a fascinating symptom, everybody wants to talk about it. I often feel that I'm the least qualified person to talk about them. I still find them fascinating to think about. And so actually, this is some of the work started way back in my PhD, where part of it was based in a lab where we worked with people with Parkinson's disease. And a symptom that not many people even are aware of in Parkinson's, but yet is actually very common, is that these patients can experience visual hallucinations. So that's how that area of interest got started for me. And I suppose it's quite different to a lot of the work that people have done in hallucinations that often comes from psychiatric illnesses, particularly with psychosis and schizophrenia, where visual hallucinations are not as common as auditory hallucinations, but that's where a lot of the work and the thinking of how we think about these symptoms comes from, these kind of psychiatric illnesses. However, in Parkinson's, it's this quite unique disease model to think about them, because the vast majority of them are visual and they tend to unfold on a trajectory that's sort of quite well established, in that they often start with these things that we call minor hallucinations. So those types of hallucinations are where you might have something like an illusion, where you misperceive something in your environment. You're in the garden and you see a hose and you think it's a snake. So there's something there that causes a misperception. Other types of minor hallucinations might be the sort of feeling of presence behind you, like you feel like somebody's there, or you feel like somebody's just brushed past you. So we talk about these minor phenomena and tend to happen sort of earlier in the disease course. Whereas when we talk about complex hallucinations, they're more what people would classically think of hallucinations, where you're having a perceptual experience of something. In Parkinson's, it tends to be a sort of visual experience of a person or an animal or some figure, something like that. You're having a visual perceptual experience, but in the absence of, there's no stimulation there that's causing the stimulus. So in that way, that's sort of how it differs to a misperception, where misperception, there's something in the environment that's causing you to misinterpret it. Whereas a complex or fully formed hallucination, and the terminology does differ, but it's more that quite vivid, immersive visual experience without any stimuli there.
And just to confirm, so because I don't want everyone to listen to this and then all think like the misperceptions can be common in healthy individuals as well, right?
Yeah, no, that's a really
very
important point to make. And actually, I mean, it's a point that really unravels a really fascinating field of research. I mean, first of all, a lot of the things that we sort of think about as symptoms that go along with psychiatric illnesses, they occur on a continuum. There's not a dichotomy between somebody who's has these and doesn't have these is completely well or not completely well. I mean, in the healthy population, we will often experience some of these symptoms. And then it's when it gets to a certain level of burden or causes a certain amount of distress that contributes to these illnesses. But yeah, these things like these sort of hallucinations or misperceptions or perceptual glitches, that they happen in the same way as well, in that it's something that we can certainly experience in everyday life in people who don't have a psychiatric or neurodegenerative illness. I mean, I can't count the number of times where I misperceive something and nearly jump out of my skin. When probably it happens more when I'm tired or it's a bit dark. So there certainly can occur in a non-clinical population. And there's actually a really fascinating, quite large body of work now. A collaborator of mine who's at Durham University, his name's Charles Ferniehoff, and he works a lot in auditory hallucinations. But a big part of what their program of work has done is investigate these people that they call sort of voice hearers. So who are people without a psychiatric illness or a neurodegenerative illness, yet they quite consistently hear voices. They have hallucinations. So which is just to say that they're certainly not always part of a clinical condition. And there's certainly sort of a section of the population who is probably having these types of perceptual experiences perhaps more frequently than others, yet they don't sort of fall under the category of having one of these types of illnesses.
Okay, great. Yeah, I just wanted to clarify that because I didn't want people to listen and be like, oh no, I've got, I always misperceive the hose as a snake. And am I okay?
Yeah, no, it's an important clarification. And it's certainly something, it's sort of equally important as well, actually. If we think about our patients with Parkinson's, it's equally important that they understand that that's a possibility and that it's part of their disease. Because one of the really difficult things about hallucinations, and particularly researching them in diseases of aging, so neurodegenerative illnesses, or even in diseases where people have eye illness and hallucinations, is that people, if they have these experiences, they start to think, oh my, I'm going mad. What's wrong with me? I can't tell anyone about this, you know. But whereas if you have something like Parkinson's or the hallucinations that occur with macular degeneration, in which we call Charles-Bonnet syndrome, it's super important to let people know that, look, these can happen and that they're part of the disease process. It doesn't mean that you're losing your mind or whatever they might be worried about. So it's very important to get the language right and explain these in the proper way to people.
So is the mechanism of experiencing a hallucination the same for Parkinson's as it is if you have a psychedelic drug? Is it all the same mechanism or is it different?
Because with all that wittering on I just did about hallucinations, we didn't even talk about the neurotransmitter systems. But of course, as you alluding to, that these systems are of course important. And one way that we clearly know that is when we give psychedelics to people, that they can have really sort of fantastical hallucinations. Trying to discover whether the mechanisms are the same or different across disorders is a tricky one to nut out. I mean, I think inevitably there's going to be commonalities across different conditions. But even if we just focus on Parkinson's disease, even there, the contribution of different neuromodulatory systems is still quite unknown. So in terms of initially to help people with Parkinson's, we give them dopaminergic drugs. And so there was initial evidence that the dopaminergic drugs would exacerbate hallucinations. So people thought, oh, dopamine hallucinations. But then careful sort of investigations into that said that wasn't the full story. There's a lot of cholinergic dysfunction in Parkinson's, and we know that, for example, anticholinergic drugs, if you give them to people, that can cause hallucinations. So we know that cholinergic is probably playing a role. And then coming back to serotonergic, then these 5-HT2 receptors that we were talking about, the main receptor that's thought to underpin the psychedelic experience. So when we give people a psychedelic, these drugs, like any neuropharmacological drugs, they're messy. They hit a lot of receptors. They hit a lot of different systems. But the real sort of common receptor that is agonized by these drugs is the 5-HT2A, which seems to be important for the psychedelic experience. And so we know in Parkinson's that there is some link between changes at that receptor level and people with hallucinations. So I think that's a sort of roundabout way of saying that we do think there's common systems involved across disorders and probably common systems, but also common principles in the way that there's different levels of dysfunction between sort of top-down and bottom-up sensory information that can predispose people to hallucinations. Those sort of general frameworks would be common across disorders as well.
Okay, amazing. Well, do you want to just finish by saying what you're working on next that you're excited about?
Yeah, sure. Working on lots of things that we're excited about. To keep it on a more of a neuromodulatory systems track, is we're going to get started some more single dose drug studies. And that's one way that we can use to understand better these neuromodulatory systems in humans, by giving them a one-off dose of a drug that we know modulates certain neuromodulatory systems, and then putting them in the scanner and making them do behavioral tests and that sort of thing. So seeing how this one-off dose changes the brain and behavior. So we're planning some studies with that. One arm of the studies will be in people with Parkinson's, where we've got some ideas that these drugs are actually noradrenergic drugs, so drugs that act on a particular receptor of the noradrenergic system. We think it'll help some symptoms in Parkinson's. But then the other work is going to be just giving the drugs in healthy people, because we think it's an interesting way to perturb the brain and perhaps change behavior. And sort of by doing that, by comparing people on and off the drug under fMRI scanning, we can come to some better understanding about what exactly these systems are doing at that systems level. Because for all of these drugs, we have beautiful knowledge of their neurobiology at the cellular level, because they're measured in animals and we can make nice models of them and that sort of thing. But understanding the circuit level, how these changes manifest at the systems level when we look at people during fMRI scanning and that sort of thing, is stuff that we still don't know a lot about.
Thank you to Dr. Claire Callahan for joining us this episode. Our intro and outro music is Nobody Stayed for the DJ by Glacio. Our transition music is Back for More, also by Glacio. Minds Matter is mixed, edited, and created by Beth Fisher, she's the Australian one, and me, Ava Madisouza. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a brand new episode, but in the meantime, find all our episodes and show notes on mindsmatterpodcast.com.